So, this SQL statement walks into a bar. He says, "Mind if I join these two tables?" Welcome, Nerd Roundup. It's Friday. If you haven't been to a Nerd Roundup before, I'm Daniel Markham at danielbmarkham.com. Our guest today, James Grinning. Nerd Roundup is nothing useful at all. It's full of content, but no, full of detail, but no content. What we do is we sit down with people who are programmers and coders. We talk about cool tech stuff we've been looking at over the last week. There are no rules to this thing, but I'd make a list of links we go through. You don't have to read the articles. You just have fun. And today, James Grinning. Mr. James.
Dan. Hi, hey, look at those two dudes there. I remember them.
All right, so I got to tell a story. So it's Agile 2014, 7 years ago. 7 years ago today, actually. And you and I had been friends on the internet for some time, and we met for the first time in Tim Ottinger's 3D class he did. And I said, "We got to go have a drink. I mean, this is a conference. We have to go to the bar." So we went to the bar, and I was trying to impress you with being a smart person. I think you were trying to show me how clever you were. So you gave me a riddle. I don't remember the riddle itself. But I remember the answer was something to do with Doctor Who. So you asked me this question, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm eager to try and I tried guessing. I had never seen Doctor Who. And so both of us kept sticking to it. Like, you kept giving more hints and smiling because you thought it would be funny once I figured it out. And I kept struggling. Is it a bread box? Does it look like a cow? went for 10 minutes.
I think the Doctor Who part is fake news. But I do remember there was a riddle thing going on, but I don't remember it was Doctor Who. But I don't remember what it is, so who knows? It could have been.
I didn't know to begin with. Like, I didn't know the whole time. I know I spent 10 minutes.
The Doctor Who watching happened decades before that.
I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, I'm never ever going to guess a thing I don't know. It's just not going
to
happen.
Oh, come on now.
That was fun.
Yeah, that was a good time, though.
Yeah, pretty good time.
Very good.
So let's hit the articles. As I understand it, you just got back from the eye doctor, right?
Yeah. Oh, wait. Was I supposed to laugh at that joke? That was hilarious.
I don't know.
SQL walks into a bar.
No. Please do not. The scream is the thing. So I redid the whole intro. It's half as long. It begins with a scream. I figure I should just give people a good idea what they're going to be facing over the next hour. So.
That was a good one. Yeah. Yeah, I just went to the eye doctor, so my eyes dilated right now. It's kind of a nuisance. I can kind of read some of the stuff in front of me. I can see Daniel there on the other monitor.
So what have you been up to this past week or two?
Well, relocated back to Illinois for a couple of months. My wife and I go back and forth between Florida and Illinois. Right now the office is in Illinois again. So that means bringing two key pieces of equipment, three, that camera, my SSD card, 2 terabyte SSD card, and my graphics card, which is making all this possible here. It gets plugged into the chassis in the corner here, and now I'm back on live with the same computer I left in Florida.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it works pretty good. And aside from that, I've been starting to get kind of busy, which is, after this lull of...
A couple weeks ago, didn't you give a class to a larger group of people, you were telling me?
Yeah, I was using GatherTown, and I did a class with more people, and so that's going to be the new normal, because they actually discovered that they could work together, because they were having trouble because of their firewall getting to one of my servers, and they said, "Well, in our Gather room, we just shared screens and got past the problem." It's like,
oh, wow.
Yes, this is exactly what's supposed to happen. Yes. People working together and getting stuff done.
I've had people tell me they couldn't pair program even sitting side by side because security wouldn't let two people touch the same keyboard.
Yeah, right. Yeah, those damn security people.
Crazy stuff. So the first article is by Alan Holub, I think you pronounce his name. I've been sort of acquaintances with Alan for 5 or 10 years now. Alan's a technical coach. The articles.
Yeah, I see him all the time, articles and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I do too. I see him on Twitter, and I also see him on LinkedIn. Heuristics for effective software development, a continuously evolving list. So basically, he put together a list of things to remember to make good software. And it's, it's a lot of stuff, 26 items here. So my comment, and I have nothing against Alan, there's nothing really wrong with it. This type of list drives a lot of programmers crazy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, for instance, without psychological safety, respect, and trust, none of the following is possible. That's a true statement. I believe that to be very important. However,
which number is that?
What the hell does psychological safety mean? Like you're...
treat each other nice.
I can give you more. Yes, I can throw more words at it. Be nice. I can give you a bunch of words, but at the end of the day, you're going to have somebody who's brutally honest saying, but I am being nice. I'm being brutally honest. And it's a lot of interpretation involved here. And that does tend to make us a little crazy as coders.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. Psychological safety is a little too prevalent in our world today.
Yeah, I the only real criticism I have, aside from this being sort of intractable, is the fact that whatever you're doing should give you some sort of negative feedback from time to time, or you should not be doing it, right? It shouldn't be fun all the time. If it is, then you're obviously not learning or stretching or anything. It's you should have some discomfort in life.
Yep. Yeah, so just to kind of bounce off of that one, I have to put stuff down sometimes for months. Like I have... integration with Cyber Dojo for my training classes, and the Cyber Dojo interface has marched on and I've fallen behind a little bit, and it does involve some knowledge which I don't use very often, like fiddling around with Nginx and other stuff like that. And so now when there's a new release and it's time to do it, I can't just go and spend 5 minutes, even though the change is probably one line of code. I've got to go re-immerse myself into this thing and get my head back to where it was back in January the last time I talked to John Jagger about it. And then I discover after a day, oh, it is pretty easy.
Yeah.
But
oh yeah,
all the relearning and this inability to have this retention of all these all these details which software developers have to keep track of, right?
Yeah. But it's kind of a universal skill. We talk about Yagni as far as coding design, but Yagni's true for most dang near everything. I mean, if the behavior pulls the structure out of the system, so you were fine for all that time, even though the back end changed. But at some point, you needed behavior that you couldn't get out of there, so you were a little uncomfortable having to go back and do the work. But you were forced to do the work, right?
Yeah, I have to do it. And I leave some breadcrumbs behind, and then John feeds me some more breadcrumbs. and I can, kind of figure it out in this world of stuff that lots of people get, JSON and web requests and gets and posts and all the stuff, which I'm, as a novice web developer, web developer.
Yeah. I saw online today somebody tweeted that they went to an interview and they asked him if he knew JSON. He said, no, is he another developer?
It's funny you said that, because the first time I heard the words, I think it came out of Ron Jeffrey's mouth, and I thought he was talking about somebody, in our group. It's like, I don't know this Jason guy.
He's everywhere. Dang, he's doing everything.
Yeah.
When I first saw Jason, I wish I could say I was impressed, but I was more like, okay, we got text config, any files, we got config files, we got XML files. We got conf files in Unix. We've got like a sixth or seventh different configuration to pass data around.
Yep.
I like it much better now than I did when I first saw it, because it integrates right into JavaScript. That's a cool thing about it.
I just wish JSON would accept a trailing comma.
Hmm.
The last element of the list, like many things do.
Yes, because
I was surprised to find that C allows it. You can put an extra comma in there, and C doesn't care.
No, not so much in JavaScript, my friend. No, and yeah, in JavaScript too. If you're not careful, it will add a automatically add a semicolon at the end of the line and screw up your code. People do that with if-thens and all the time.
You know what? Really, okay. Now you just made me hit on a pet peeve. Go to somebody's blog where there's example code there, and you think, oh, well, yeah, they put code on there in their blog, so it must be, compilable, syntactically correct, et cetera. But their spell checker capitalized some of the words.
Oof.
So none of it will work, right?
Yeah, I use the Prism plugin for code blocks and the pre thing, and it's really cool. It gets the syntax highlighting. It's got a copy button you can copy right out. It's want me to tell you something? Oh, yes. It's neat.
Very cool. That's cool. Yeah, I'm noticing that John uses that in Cyber Dojo, John Jagger, the creative Cyber Dojo. You might want to, well, I should introduce you to John sometime.
Yeah.
Hey, so on Alan's list here,
was there any
that struck you that, you know, any like you said, oh, yeah, I'm glad that's on the list?
I'm not a fan. These are all good things. I'm not, like I said, Alan's a great guy. I'm not disagreeing with it. It's just, it all seems like so much bullshit to me. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's not bad. It's like if I told you, you know, James, you know, we need to be efficient to be effective or something. You know, I can say things that sound as if they have content, but they don't really. Here's my rule. If two reasonable people can get into an argument or long discussion over like terms inside of one of these things, then it's difficult to sort of really get value out of here.
And actually, I don't know if these have any. The ones I've read don't seem to be particularly about software development.
Yeah, quality's not
negotiable. I was expecting to see something like separate object creation from object usage.
This is more technology development process stuff.
Yeah,
everything's an experiment. Prediction is unreliable. Well, that's why they call them predictions. At some point, it's all sort of circular reasoning. And I like I said, I know he means well, and you have to get this stuff out. But what I see, one of the reasons I don't use the A word anymore, I see a lot of people rehashing shit that I kind of learned 20 years ago. And I don't want to spend another 20 years going. One of the reasons here, this is once you get
into
process.
Which A word was that?
Once you get into process, you move out of code, you're really getting into management consulting. And management consulting is an unsolved problem. If it were solved, you know, we wouldn't have 50 books a year coming out on it. So it's very untractable, and coders, it just kind of makes them a little crazy.
I know the solution.
What? It's 42?
No, have developers that have really good skills, then it'd be much easier to manage.
Yeah. You know, I was one of the first times I did consulting as a team lead, they asked me what I would recommend for the company-wide training. It was about 800 people in the company. And I said, you know, negotiation. Because if you can negotiate, you can talk about estimates, features. There's so many things that involve sort of interpersonal, just I've got this, you've got that, let's do some trading. And we tend to be very bad at it. And that's what they did, company-wide classes, and everybody loved it. It's good stuff.
Yep.
So the next one. Go ahead.
I went to a negotiating class once. It was important. So you're mentioning that. So definitely an important thing. You know, so it's like, because people are going to ask you for something, and it's a good idea to have something that you're willing to give, because sometimes you don't care. The guy used a kind of a cute term. It's called you got to find the $10,000 kitten. And I forget, there's probably an article about this somewhere. This is well before the internet. But he said in every business deal, there's a $10,000 kitten. You don't mind selling your kitten for $10,000, right? Somebody else values it as 10. It doesn't hurt you as much, and you want to find those give and take items, you know. So if somebody wants a lower price, maybe they could pay sooner, right? You know, there's usually some give and take.
Once you reduce any negotiation to just one axis or one variable, it's a win-lose situation. It's very bad. So the last thing in the world you want to do is just make it just about rate, or what you want to do is find that kitten where, okay, fine, I'll give you this. I don't care about cats. You don't care about the money. We can trade. But if you just make it one thing where there has to be winner and loser, it usually doesn't work out so well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took a negotiation course. Roger Dawson has a set of CDs. I think you can get still from Amazon. I doubled my billing rate like within a week.
Oh, don't tell your customers.
Well, this was in my early, mid-20s. I think I went from like 45 an hour to like 90 an hour like in a week. It's like, wow.
Probably were worth it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's best like 20, 30 bucks I ever spent, really. So the next one is the Navy needs a new way to write software. And this is written by a couple captains who are retired. I will tell you the long and short of this. They want to go model-driven development using SysML, which is sort of a Lotus from the object management group. The idea, this is model-based software engineering. And the idea is that by gummy, you make the model compiles into provable code, and it's just a matter of pushing a button, and you know, everybody can just go home, go grab a beer.
I don't want to say it's not that it's not possible, but it's been tried before. And so how is it different here? Have they done it and it works?
Well, yeah.
I remember Steve Miller was a huge advocate of this at the Agile Manifesto meeting. And basically they put the model together and then they write all kinds of code to turn the model into what they wanted. If I understood it right, I didn't completely understand it. And then one of my clients invested a lot in using Rational Rows.
Oh, yeah.
I remember talking to them. There used to be a much more dominant world power. I'm not going to mention who they are in electronics. We went to the VP's office in the early days of extreme programming. We're trying to sell them on the idea of helping more of their teams out because we did some pilots. And they said, we don't view coding as a valuable skill. Design is a valuable skill. We're going to get coding done by low-cost areas, you know, like India and China, and we'll do the design work here. And, you know, we're trying to get out of that because we know coding is not a valuable skill.
Yeah, that's
and then 20 years later, they had to abandon their model-driven approach because finally IBM abandoned Rational Rows. And now that they have this huge product built on top of this generated code base.
I have done model-driven development successfully on more than 3 or 4 occasions. I'm also not a believer.
State machines, I think I can believe that.
Yeah, the thing is that as you develop code, you're actually understanding the requirements better as you write the code.
Yeah.
And you can only test a model so many ways in your head. Usually I'll take a class structure model and I'll walk through the behaviors, use cases, or user stories and say, okay, does this class model support these behaviors? And that's a good way of doing things, but you just don't really know. You're down there catching an exception somewhere off a piece of code and you're going, oh my God, I have the wrong idea what this thing meant over here. And so it's the old architect problem. You can't have a guy sitting in a tower somewhere. The whole thing has to work together.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times these summer pilot projects are very small teams who are doing round tripping all the way through the code and coming back. And they're actually doing the extra analysis work you would have to do as a coder, but they're not realizing it. So they're thinking, oh, well, gee, we just pushed a button and everything. And it's like, no, actually, coding is a requirements process as well. As you code, you're having conversations with that product owner.
Yep. There are minute details that really only surface once you've gotten into the details.
Yes. And, because there's if you could remember all that stuff by looking at a model, if you can all that, then you wouldn't need programmers at all. And that's not, like you said, that's 20 years ago they thought that. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I don't know what the level of detail can't be avoided. I think we're both agreeing on that, right?
Right. And I think part of the problem is that product owners will use sort of conceptual terms, do stuff faster is sort of the ridiculous example, but they'll use terms in which everybody in the room thinks they understand and whatever. But once you start saying a type up in a code, piece of code, and using that type, you're like, oh, wait a minute. Now, by this word, did you mean this other stuff here? And if you want to use models like John Kern did that together code, right, where you model and code at the same time back and forth, that's cool with me. I don't see a problem with that.
Yeah, I actually find having graphical models of code to be super valuable for communicating ideas.
Yes.
And you can get lost in just text.
Yes.
You know? So having the model is there and has a very important purpose.
Yes.
And lets you play what if, and then you start to get into the code. It's got to work there. I don't know how many times we started with a model and then had everybody agree and then go down the path 15 minutes later, realize, oh, this code's not workable.
Yeah, it's a good point. Cause I don't mean to say that I find a model driven development useless. In fact, I think what's interesting to me is it actually is more useful for the people than it is the code.
Yeah. Right,
so the picture of what you're doing is useful. You can take 30 people in a room and walk through a picture easily.
That's right. Get that image.
Yeah. So I think that we're taking something and trying to make code out of it that's really better suited to help people agree on stuff.
Yeah.
So the next story is you can't tell people anything.
Huh.
And so this is a guy who worked at.
I object to that.
I knew you'd say that. I can't tell you. So this guy worked at Morningstar for 20 years. He's like, well, before I retire, I want to give you guys like some advice. And he said, really? He worked at Lucasfilm and a bunch of other stuff. And the long and short of it was just what we talked about is you can tell people things and they can agree, but they don't really understand it or grok it at all. They'll wander off and do whatever they want to do. And it's easy to think you're telling somebody something because they agree or smile, but that doesn't mean you're really telling them anything.
Yeah.
He brings up an example. At Lucasfilm, they created these rendering machines, and Fujitsu wanted to use them, so they had this meeting, and they walked them through the machine and told them all about it. And the Fujitsu guys are like, yes, this is good. We can go do this. And then the guys went to Japan, never could get the thing working, and it was like 5 years before he finally got a chance to go see what was going on. And they had actually said, yes, they understood, but then went back and coded it all as like a time serve, like the old mainframe system instead of a client server, which was in vogue at the time. So they understood what the guy was saying, but once they got lost, they just went back muscle memory to the stuff they'd already coded.
Yeah.
Just didn't work.
Yeah.
So, no, you can't tell any people anything, and I agree with that. I think that's one of the reasons stuff like you do, where you tell them, and then you walk through it, and then they do it. That's the best way of doing any of this stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. When I get the newbies trying test driven for the first time, and then I ask them what they thought about it, you know, when I first started asking what they thought about it, you know, right away, the first time I ever taught anybody, I was expecting a certain answer. And when one brave person would give that to me, I would say, well, the whole group got it. And they love, you know, this, and we're going to keep going. And all the time they're all fighting internally with themselves, right? Because they didn't get it. I had people write down in post-it notes, I think you've participated in this, you know, well, I'm worried about this.
Yes.
I'm worried about it taking too long. I'm worried about not being able to think of the test.
What do you want from this class? You don't post-it notes on the wall. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm worried about this, and this. It's like, oh, wow, everybody's got a different concern.
I made a comment on this article because this is a painful personal story. When I finally went into just coaching tech teams, I thought it would be pretty easy. Like, I'm like, hey, I know this stuff. You tell me what you want to know. I will tell you, and then you will know it. This seems like a pretty simple gig. You know, gee, I know how to do it. You don't? Hey.
I used to think that.
It's kismet, yeah. And, you know, it took me a long time with a lot of pain. I did jokes. I did rubber chickens. I did classes, games. I did all this stuff in an attempt to, like, why are you not receiving the message? And it really boiled down.
Did you have a hole in your head?
Yeah, I did. It boiled down to just not. Here's the way I put it. You could conceptually understand something and agree with it, and it sounds good. And you leave the room, and you go back to your IDE, and there's like a dozen little problems, like how to organize my files. What do I, you know, how do I name my variables that seem insurmountable to you? And so you just give up on all of it. It just seems way too much. Whereas if you're forced to actually work through the whole problem round trip, you have to go through all those little pieces that you didn't know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it took me a while to figure. I'll never forget my, mentoring worked a lot. But when I did mob programming, when I saw like 5 or 10 people learning one time, I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. Yeah, it was cool stuff.
No doubt. Yeah.
So this next one is maker of dubious $56,000 Alzheimer's drug creates a cognitive test that nobody can pass. So this $56,000 drug. Do you need this? Here, take this test. And everybody fails the test.
Like, everybody needs it.
Money. Yes.
That's a hell of a market. How do we invest in this company? Everybody needs it. All right.
Yes, take our test where we help you figure out whether you
need to get it. It's a 6-question quiz, huh?
Yeah. Like, do you ever forget things like a doctor appointment or lunch date? Oh, boy.
I mean, like today? I didn't do that today.
Well, not. Yeah. Do you ever feel more anxious or irritable than you typically do? Come
on. I mean, not right at this moment. But yesterday, yeah.
I'm getting this way. I'm reading this list, yeah. So, they were called out on this. It's like, this is a little self-serving, guys. I think they may have pulled it by now, but yeah. Don't take the test from the people who's selling you the $50,000 drug. You're not going to do well on it.
Well, you know, I have a similar thing with embedded systems. I have a very wide definition of embedded systems so that I can help a lot of different people.
Well, you should do what I do. I'm doing like how to think about technology. So robot lunar bases, whatever. It just works. You know what I need? I need a six question quiz to give people.
Yeah,
have you ever used a computer?
Yes.
So this next one is, why does a universe exist at all? And it's just
yeah, because there's this has to be about the imbalance of antimatter and matter, right?
Or what? No, actually, it's about Stephen Wolfram. Do you know who Stephen Wolfram is?
No.
Stephen won the Fields Medal. Super smart genius guy. If you don't believe me, just ask him. He'll tell you. he's a very, very shy person. Yeah, he won a bunch of awards. Boy genius, went off, formed a software company, made even more money, and now he's taking his theories about software and trying to figure out how the universe runs like a computational machine. There's a book 20 years ago. He came out with a book called A New Kind of Science. It's about 500 pages. I read it. It was a good book, but I couldn't really tell whether he was onto something or just a crazy person. Had a lot of good pictures. But there he is. Basically, have you ever played the Conway's Game of Life where the cells turn off and on?
Sure, yeah.
Well, his sort of make it into sort of a comic book explanation version. He thinks the universe may run on simple rules like that. Instead of running in a two-dimensional grid, they actually create nodes like dot to dot to dot. And that's actually what space-time is. He claims to start this simple thing and come out with relativity, gravitation, all this other stuff.
Well, cool.
Yeah, it's just like a bear's watching. I have no idea.
Well, somebody tried to solve this problem before, too. The people at Stanford Linear Accelerator, a bunch of physicists, used to be an object mentor client back when I was working with Bob, and we were teaching them object-oriented design. They had this research project going on. It was called B-bar. I guess they were looking for the B-bar particle or something. And they were trying to find out why there's more matter than antimatter. And it's really fun to try to teach a physicist who's like way smarter, PhD physicist, way smarter than me, teach him about object-oriented design when what he knows about programming is Fortran.
Oh, wow.
Pretty much every class diagram starts looking like a flowchart. But at any rate, I think it was the first petabyte database ever. Was what they collected, petabyte amount of data. I don't know if it was a database, but that they had to process looking for these super rare events.
I work with a hardcore hardware engineering group right after the dot-com crash, 2001 or two. And like same situation, full of really, really, really smart people. And that's a different kind of challenge.
Yeah.
At some point you feel like dad, like just because I told you so, stop asking questions. Okay. Don't make me stop this car. Yeah. Smart guys.
Yep.
So this next one is a Harvard astronomer revolutionizes search for alien life with new project. And so the general idea here, he's sort of responding to this unidentified aerial phenomena, UFO thing that's been going on for a few months. He's like, okay, how about this? How about instead of like having people do reports in the field and coming in and us trying to sort out what's what, how about we take all the data everywhere, all the telescopes, if you're collecting star data or anything with the atmosphere, send it in and we'll run a neural net over it and try to find interesting patterns like stars that move, stars that blink or whatever. And instead of looking for one thing, we'll just have the code base look for interesting things and then we'll go through and look over there, see what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool idea.
Yeah. It sounds cool.
All right. I'll look forward to seeing more from that.
Yeah.
Next one is, this is a sort of a strategic thinking. Why is China smashing its tech industry? And it goes over a lot of different companies. This Ma guy who was a billionaire, they took him to jail, stripped him of all his money. There's three or four examples of China really coming down hard on their tech community.
Probably they want some freedom.
Well, and his conclusion is that what China's done is they figured out social media sucks. And so they'll just beat the hell out of anybody's doing social media stuff. But people who are doing hardware like cell phones or whatever, they're just changing their industrial focus. It made sense to me, and it tracks with what they've been doing. So if you're like doing
They're continuing to do cell phones or?
Oh, yeah. Not? Hardware stuff. They're actually concentrating more on building stuff in factories and mechanical things and much, and sort of giving people a hard time. They're doing this, iFart and things that are silly.
I don't know about iFart, but that's okay.
Yeah, the guy made over a million dollars. You push a button, it makes a farting sound. That's a big deal, yeah. That was almost the size of Flappy Bird. Hey, you ever play Flappy Bird?
No.
Oh, my God. James, Flappy Bird. Oh, wow. That guy made
Flapping Bird.
Yes.
No.
Oh, yeah. That's he didn't even want the – well, he, of course, took the money, but it was a guy in, I think, Thailand. And he'd read up a bunch on how to make addictive games, and he made a game called Flappy Bird. And he, like I said, made $1 million on it. And he went into hiding. He was like, "Don't call me. Don't look for me. I didn't want to end up here."
And I might play something else instead of Flappy Bird.
Ah, there you go. Billiards.
I use my left hand, Dan. How about you?
Yeah, if we played again, I'd probably still shoot with the wrong hand. We're shooting like, hey, I didn't know you were left-handed. Like, I didn't know I was left-handed either. Like, you're shooting backwards. Oh, wow, no wonder I suck at this.
You got a lot better after you switched hands.
Yeah, no.
And I figured your wife told you to do it that way.
Wow. I'd rather remember the Doctor Who joke than that one. That was, in your defense, I sing your praises to this day because you were very patient. Okay, this is how we're, actually you're doing this completely backwards. Yeah, I felt like the guy who couldn't tie his shoes.
Well, you know,
Eyes Wide Shut: How Newborn Mammals Dream the World That They're Entering, and this is like another super cool one because what they did was they looked at the retinas of unborn mice, and they found that they're seeing these sort of waves through the retinal system that are the same as if they were outside the womb. And so what this does, and it's actually translates over to machine learning and neural net stuff, is that it's a biologically programmed sort of pre-sorting. They call it a magic lottery ticket. You just sort of, you give the system a general idea of how it's going to act in the future, even if it has no stimulus yet. And then when it gets stimulus, it's able to go right into the stimulus much quicker.
Yeah, okay. So the nerves are doing stuff in here, trying to get wired into the brain. So the brain understands when nerves do stuff in the eye. Cool.
And you see the same thing at colts are like born and able to stand and run around within an hour or two. It's the same thing. They think that the neural system is actually training itself before they're born.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
And so that training would happen through genetic memory?
I guess so. They don't know. Another interesting thing about this is they're actually figuring the brain out, starting with the eyeball, which is weird. They start with the photoreceptors. I think they're down to about 7 or 8 levels now. It turns out that you're more easy to understand the brain by starting in through the visual system.
What?
Yeah. Well, because you know exactly what the stimulus is. It's an image. Right?
Yeah.
And you know what the rods and cones are because we have doctors that study that. And then there's, I think, 7 layers inside the eye, and then there's an optic nerve. And they're just modeling and studying each layer all the way down as they get through the optic nerve, and it'll go across the system. Yeah, cool stuff.
Yeah.
And I also have a link to the Hacker News discussion of this. This talks about the machine learning stuff. It's a couple papers here. If you're more interested in this stuff, this would be the place to dive into.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Having just been to the eye doctor, I definitely want people to be smart about what to do with eyes.
Last time I was at the eye doctor, the guy said, "Oh, you have a really nice-looking eyeball. Mind if I show it to my friend?" I'm like, "It's just going to be on the internet. You're going to buy me dinner?" So he said, no, hang on. So he comes back in, and this other lady, she gets a light out. "Oh, check this eyeball." And they're all, like, looking at my eyeball, and I to this day, I don't know what they're doing.
Maybe it was bloodshot?
No, yeah, could have been. Yeah, they never write. They never call. I don't know. I was there.
That's with them.
Yeah. Okay, so see this really cool picture I have here?
Yeah. Computers riding a bicycle? Is that this
computers
one?
Computers riding bicycles. So it's a PDF, and I've got it up on my G drive. So it takes two neurons to ride a bicycle. And this researcher tried to train a neural net on riding bicycles. So he, Matthew Cook, he created a little bicycle dude here. And he set the little neural net to riding the bike. And he and this is all the times the bike fell down and different ways it went. And he found out that you have to have at least two neurons. This sort of reminds me of the generative adversarial network. Remember talking about the one that feeds off the other, sort of bouncing back and forth? You have to have at least two neurons to ride a bike. You can't ride a bike with one neuron.
So this mean you can ride a bike and chew gum at the same time?
That'd probably be three neurons for that, which is coming close to my limit. I don't know if I'm... Because I've got the one neuron for looking, and then the two for riding the bike gets... Yeah, I'm running out pretty quick on that.
I think you got more than that.
I tell my kids I've got like six brain cells, and they're all busy right now. Don't give me something else to do.
The two-neuron network.
Yeah, and it's two-neuron... Yeah, isn't that cool? I wonder how much we're going to run into artificial intelligence actually being this sort of A versus B situation where you're creating two different mental models and the two models have to somehow compete for attention or something. That would be really cool if it turns out to be. You know, there's this theory of consciousness that actually your brain's all the time processing multiple models, and what you consider to be conscious is just sort of the fight, how those little models are sort of fighting one another.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody says, well, what was that person's name that we did with so-and-so? And you go, oh, I don't know, but maybe I'll know in a little while.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, boom, you know, brain reports.
And the thing is, you'll be thinking about some other thing. And it's like somehow, somewhere in the back, there's some other piece still working on that problem.
That's right. Yeah. Parallel processing.
One of the things I found as a programmer, and I find writing this stuff I'm doing now, is that some of the best time I can spend, I get up and go do something else. And as long as I can frame the problem really well, I'll continue to work on it. And I find that with teams, when I used to have, work with teams and we'd have a tough problem, I would write it on the whiteboard in front of the team and not do anything, just write it there. And we'd continue developing or whatever, and just having it on the wall, nine times out of ten within a week or so, somebody would go, oh, you know, this is when you do it this way.
Yeah, because, you know, I think if you talk out loud, and I think this probably drives my wife crazy, I'll just start talking and the words come out as the thoughts are being formed. And so I say stupid stuff. But it helps you, the connection. It's weird that what comes out in your mouth has to get connected back into your brain through your ears.
Yes.
And, seeing something on a board. And I know I probably don't remember things as well since I stopped taking notes with a pen. Because I think that act of taking notes with a pen, if I really remember something now, I go and write it down and then I throw the paper out. I still forget it most of the time, but I'd probably fail that test, right?
Well, my consulting, the way I do consulting is I take a pen and paper through the day. Right now, things are important. And then when I get back, I I recycle through what I've written and recap it in my notebook. And then I've actually sort of processed it twice, throw the paper away. And I find I get probably 10 times the retention that I would if I just tried one or the other.
Yeah.
It's funny. I've noticed some guys I would consider to be really good programmers that they talk to themselves. It's quite common. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not.
Well, wait. You wanted to talk about arguing.
No, I don't.
Simple contradiction, Daniel.
That's not argument. Argument's it's no, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not.
Okay. You know, so on this, I know there's a. I never had a professor that did this, but one of the guys that I used to work with said, if you had a programming problem, you first had to stop by the teddy bear outside the professor's door, and you had to tell your problem to the teddy bear. And then after you've talked to the teddy bear, if you still don't know what you need to do, then knock on the door, right? You know, so, and like the guy said, all day long, people would be out there talking to the teddy bear. No one ever knocked on the door.
Oh, wow. Yeah, people probably wonder what that guy was teaching. Like, oh boy, it's kind of weird. Whatever he's teaching involves conferencing with teddy bears.
Yep.
It's rubber duck debugging. It's weird, and I think that you can take advantage of that as a programmer by purposely doing other things and this type of stuff we're talking about. This next one is water as a metal. Did you know that you could turn water into a metal?
Wouldn't it be, okay, a metal. I guess I don't, yeah. I mean, I have to brush up on my chemistry, but ice is a crystal. It's right. Not a metal. Yeah. And water itself is not an element.
And, well, so, water's H2O, and it's got the outer electron shell filled with those eight electrons, right?
Okay.
Two from the hydrogen, six from the oxygen. You're full up, and you shouldn't be able to do much anything there unless you've got a sodium or type of thing that would come in that would violently react. Well, the thing is, under enough pressure, you can actually force some of those electrons in that outer shell to sort of wander around. At that point, you've got a metal.
Okay. Now, so pure water wouldn't conduct electricity, are you saying?
Pure water does not conduct electricity, but pure water under enough pressure becomes a metal.
And then it does.
And it turns out that it only happens in the center of Jupiter, maybe Saturn, and so nobody's been able to do it. But this guy came with this idea of actually using, I think it's potassium or sodium one. Yeah, you can't do it because you'd have to reproduce Jupiter. But they took alkali metals and water, and they somehow carefully mixed it because you don't want to, you know, remember A&W root beer, acid to water. That's how you want to do that. So they mix it together, and the way they did it was the alkali metal actually stole those electrons from that first level of water, and it turned that level of water into a metal. And you've got a little picture. It's a gold water. Turns out to be a gold-colored metal. That's just super cool.
Yeah, well, it's nice people have this time on their hands to do this.
I know I've got a good story when you go, that's nice people got... Here's a guy who learned how to fly, James. Well, yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't have time to...
Who wouldn't want to turn water into a metal? It's like...
Yeah,
it's its own reward. Daniel.
It's its own Even reward. The guy went home and like, hey, I turned water.
You can't
to metal.
Make a wedding ring out of it.
Probably. Can you turn these dirty dishes into clean ones? Is probably what you heard in return. So this is kind of a fun story. This is five weapons you've probably never heard of. And this top one here is
a paddle.
No, it looks like the top of a guitar. It's a Makul Hito. See,
we had one of those when I was a kid. It was called a wooden spoon.
You know, it's obsidian. I mean, that's a razor sharp crap sticking out. It looks like the neck of a guitar, except for instead of the body of the guitar, it's got a handle like a baseball bat. You don't get hit with that.
The skull on it is a key giveaway that something bad might happen.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so just go see if you remember. No, I knew of none of these, I don't
think. Wait, now why isn't that just a mallet? It's got the
It's razor.
Side.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You don't hit them with the flat part. This is like a slice and dice kind of deal.
Is one side of those stones, it's a wedge-shaped stone?
Yes, it's obsidian. This looks kind of dull, but it should be razor sharp on those little stones in the ends.
Yeah, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Definitely don't want to be chopped with that baby.
We have the fire lance. So you take a spear, you fill the bamboo tube with gunpowder, and it's a lance that shoots fire out the end.
This was, it's funny, I'm listening to another great course, and this one's on inventions. And gunpowder is one of the great inventions, and how the Chinese used it. They invented guns, but they kind of got tired of them. But this is one of their favorite things to do was this. And this is this Chinese artwork here?
Chinese fire lance, sure enough.
Yeah. And so that was one of their favorite ways to use gunpowder against their enemies. They liked rockets in this flamethrower thing.
Ah. Well, the next is the man catcher.
Ooh, ouch.
Yeah, it looks like, have you ever seriously considered kidnapping an armored nobleman on horseback? And this is what you would use to do that. It's a long post with a sort of circular, that's ugly looking. Yeah. That's a man catcher.
And then if you jam it onto the neck, it spreads open, and then you get the...
Yeah, I guess that's what you do. Hey, you just sort of shove it right into their neck, and then you got them.
Yeah, well, they're not going to squirm very much with one of those things around their neck.
And then we've got the bog Naka. And this is
Agnaka. This is Wolverine. Also known as a hair.
No, it's not a hair. This comb? Is Wolverine claws for people. Like you put these on your knuckles and you're. Cool stuff.
If you put a spring on it, it's one of those things you can use to hold your ponytail back. If I had one,
you could. If you had three, you could do the ponytail plus the Wolverine claws. You could sort of do a hippie superhero guy.
Okay.
The ballista. I've actually heard of the ballista. That's in Age of Empires. It's the thing that launches stuff. It's actually a sort of a supercharged crossbow, if I remember correctly.
Hmm. So no, wait. What's the title of this article? Weapons we never heard
five,
of.
Yeah.
Well, it's five weapons.
It's five totally badass weapons you've never heard of. Yes.
Because we've heard of several of these already. So.
Well, we're special, but most people probably haven't. I guess I didn't.
Most people are less violent, I guess you're saying, Daniel.
So I have one daughter, three sons. My daughter's the youngest, and she got into knives for some reason. I don't know. Maybe she felt insecure. But as her father, I thought I would get a knife. I would start doing some knife things so I could spend time with her. Ah, yeah, that's a nice little knife. And so I started buying these knives. Here's the one I'm carrying today. These dang
looks
things
like
are,
mine.
Hmm?
Looks this, like mine.
Yeah, this is a Saga. It's got the tanto blade and all that. Oh yeah, nice. Yeah. I've got that one too. But these are like $80-$100. These knives are not cheap. Freaking crazy, man. I bought one of those grandpa knives. It's like $100.
So your daughter's boyfriend is behaving, I suppose.
Well, she got sword. She has swords. She's got knives, and of course, she grew. As far as I know, she grew out of it, and now I'm stuck with 50 knives laying around the house. But if I'm ever attacked by zombies, good to go. Did you watch the giant penis shoot into the sky with the billionaire on board last week?
I didn't know. I wish I forgot about it, but I did. I was happy to see that he made it. I've sat in the mock-up of that.
Oh, cool.
It's pretty amazing. I feel like we might have talked about it, but I've talked to a number of people about it. So I was teaching a test-driven development class to a group at a company that makes big things that go into space, and they happen to have that that thing there. The windows are huge. Just imagine, have you been on a 787?
I've seen them.
But if you sit on a 787, you go, oh my gosh, why aren't all the airplanes with big windows? And these windows on the New Shepard are, quite large. And you get your own seat, you get an aisle and a window.
Oh,
it's pretty impressive.
I was very worried about this because, as far as I know, they haven't done that many flight tests. This is the first manned launch, and the owner of the company is getting on board. It just had all these sort of things that could have went wrong, and I'm really happy it worked well for him.
Yeah, and he did turn over the running of his company to other people before he left.
Ooh, yeah, he did. You're right. So there's been this big mystery, what the heck's going on with Blue Origin? Because it looks like SpaceX is way far ahead of these guys. And it turns out that there's a story this week that Blue Origin actually has a secret project to catch up called Project Jarvis. It's going to be all reusable stuff like Elon's working on. There's also another story with Blue Origin this week that Bezos offered NASA $2 billion because they lost the lunar lander contract because SpaceX has got the gear. And so Bezos is like, hey, I tell you what, I'll pay for the damn thing. If you just choose us, I'll guarantee you'll get your money back one way or another. It's like, well, that's a
well, you know.
Well, yeah, should,
cool. I could not confirm or deny the existence of any such project.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it'd be nice to write a check for $2 billion. Hey, you want to know what? $2.5 billion? Fine, I put this down. I don't know how you even do that. It's crazy.
Well, when you have a few hundred of them already, you can do that.
Yeah, Bezos has, I think, last I heard, $174 billion.
Some number like that, yeah.
All I got to tell you is he's buying lunch if we ever go out. I ain't doing no Dutch thing. He's going to buy, he's buying the whole, the burger, the fries, everything.
Yep.
wow, it's a lot of money. So this is another cool tech story. This is from the Air Force and Army. They have groups that go through and look at technology over the next 20 to 30 years to figure out where do we need to invest things. And directed energy, my friend, is where we're going. Particle beams, we're big into lasers already, free electron lasers, microwave lasers, it goes on and on. And so they go over a bunch of near-term stuff, what they're doing, and it looks pretty good. But then they talk at like 2040 or 2050 force fields. And that caught my eye because I'm like, wait a minute. We don't know no force. We have no force field technology that I know of. That's Star Trek. And there we go, the force field part.
And a tractor beam?
Yeah, we don't have tractor beams. As far as I know, trying to read between, they didn't want to provide a lot of details because it's 20, 30 years out. They're just kind of pulling it out of their ass. But I think they're saying that they can, with the right amount of particle gear, they can actually find incoming things and destroy instantly such that it would be the same as having a force field, if you follow what I'm saying, right? It's basically...
It wouldn't keep it from going any further. It would destroy it.
Would destroy it, yes. With enough energy, enough detection system, as soon as something entered a sphere, you would annihilate it immediately by shooting something at it, which would look just like a force field to anybody else.
Yeah, you know, so now it's making me think of Star Wars. You know, all these people have these directed energy weapons, but nobody can hit a damn thing. What's with that? Is there like an uncertainty principle for directed energy weapons? Like if you can actually master the technology of having a small directed energy weapon, it can't hit your target?
Well, what was the old saying that what happens if you put stormtroopers against the red shirts in Star Trek? It's like the stormtroopers can't hit them, but the red shirts die anyway because they can't live. So it's... It doesn't matter whether they can shoot them or not. They still die.
Wait, who are the red shirts?
Oh, the red shirts in Star Trek. That was a big joke. Whenever in the original series, some guy appeared wearing a red shirt, he was going to die at some point.
I better rewatch now.
Yeah, if you watch the latest Star Trek, the last Star Trek movie, where they did the reboot, they're doing something where they're going down through the atmosphere, and some guy joins him, he's wearing a red shirt. He's like, hey, this is my first job wearing the red shirt like this. And all the fans are going, oh, of course he's going to die. that was probably the best part I liked about the reboot in general. I hated, but that was funny.
Yeah, you know, I watched all those as a kid, all Star Trek, and it was great. But I'm not big at rewatching all that stuff. I love the nostalgic memory. I watch them from time. I'll probably watch them from time to time, but it was,
I find it difficult to rewatch. I watched them a bunch when I was a kid, so I don't know the show numbers, but I bet you I could tell you the titles. But I learned all that before I was like 13 or 14. It's just I haven't forgotten it. I went back through and started watching, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, and it was tough. It just, the 60s doesn't hold up so well, 60 years later.
Yeah. I just watched Outlaw Josie Wales. Ooh. And that held up pretty well.
There was a whole, what was this, the Dollar series? There was a Fistful of Dollars, a few dollars more, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's good.
Yeah. Enjoyed those as well.
Westerns hold up real well because there's just no, really, you just take technology away, give a guy a gun, stick him in the desert. You could do that today.
But Josie Wales was kind of at the end, about the end of the Civil War. I have no idea if there's any basis in fact it or not. But, it wasn't, I don't know. I'm sure people could find fault with it at portraying some stuff wrong. But it seemed like it was kind of trying to point out some of the problems at the end there. And, without it being a racial racial thing, but more about the division between the country, which was about the North and South, disagreeing about stuff and then fighting about it, right? And then how that hurt individuals. It might not have been involved in the wrong stuff.
I remain fascinated. I love history, and I love the Civil War, not because I'm a Southern apologist, but because, to me, it's the best example we have of the American culture losing. Because the South and North were the same people, worshiped the same God. One believed in slavery, the other didn't, but they believed in the same kind of government. They spoke the same language. They were brothers, across the border. These were basically the same folks, and one bunch won, one bunch lost. And so it's probably the best example we have of how we act when we really get our butts kicked. It fascinates me. I think Grant said that never has one side fought for such a horrible cause or silly cause that And I agree with Grant. He was right on this. But at the same time, it's just weird thinking of people having some sort of principled disagreement that they decide, okay, we're just not going to have a country anymore, and we're going to go out and just try to kill one another as much as we can. It's like, wow. I wonder, had the South just sort of adopted a peaceful, like, we're not going to shoot, we're not going to do anything, we're just disagreeing and not cooperating. I wonder what would have happened. I wonder what happened if you can run through all sorts of what ifs, right? Mm. And it's fun. I live in Virginia, which means, dang, 80% of the dang war was fought here. So it's,
yeah, ground zero.
Yeah, all kinds of examples there. Petersburg, when Petersburg fell, the Union dug a tunnel underneath the lines and just kept putting like all this gunpowder in to blow up a big hole so they could get through the Confederate lines, but they didn't go far enough. And so they blew the hell out of this, I mean, this huge crater. You can still go see it 150 years later. But it was like in front of the lines. So they all went running out the tunnel, and they're just sitting there in a hole like ducks. So there's just all these stories about people doing different things. There was a it's fascinating to me. What was it? There's one, Winchester, Virginia changed hands like 15 or 18 times in the war. So about every other month, you're either south or north.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, the guy and Josie Wales crossing the river. He was whistling Dixie sometimes, or singing the Star Spangled Banner the other times.
the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Right.
If you don't know if you've seen the Ken Burns series on the Civil War, really, really good. Highly recommended.
Yeah. Ken Burns.
Yeah, looking at the Burns and the stuff I've read, to me, the Civil War is just far enough back in history where you can almost think of them as being Washington and Lincoln, like people you just, Washington and Adams, people you just see only in paintings. You just can't imagine. But yet they had photography. So it was almost like our ancestors sort of coming out of the fog of the past, because, I mean, they had pictures of the battlefield. They had people, gosh, you even people doing radio shows in the 30s that were in the war. That's the first generation that sort of came out into the modern. There's one guy who died in 1952 that fought in the war. So he saw the train, the telegraph, the Civil War, World War One, World War Two, the atom bomb, airplane, radio, TV. Wow, what a life, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Flintlock to atom bomb.
Wow. Had to have been an amazing life. So what you've been consuming this week? Any books or you did the Outlaw Host, you've been reading anything? What did you say the Great Courses series was on?
This was on great inventions, that have shaped the world or something like that. And so that's been interesting. Steam engine, of course. I'm in about the 1800s probably now. And, some of the inventions are cultural too. Like, how do we mobilize a workforce and how do we communicate? And, so it's pretty interesting, interesting course. I didn't finish a chemistry one, but I'll probably pick that one up and try to do some more. I was with the PhD chemists over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
In Gainesville, Florida, so I mentioned something that they knew about. It's like, oh yeah, you guys know about Lewis numbers. It's like, oh yeah, there's Lewis numbers, and then
I want to say I lost interest. I stopped listening about 6 or 7 hours in. We start talking about the Lewis body diagrams because I couldn't visualize them. We were moving to organic chemistry, which is where I kind of bailed out as a kid. I would love to go take the class and just go right through organic chemistry. I think I would really enjoy that. But trying to do an audiobook was just too much.
Well, that's what Dr. Grenning is, a PhD organic chemist. So let me know when you want to have him on the Nerd Roundup and talk some chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do some interviews. So what I had to bring up my tablet to remember what the heck I've been reading.
What have you been reading?
Yeah, I finished Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, which is a really good essay about, a book about how we had this great moral movement in the United States to get rid of all alcohol, and we got rid of all alcohol. It was probably one of the worst things we'd ever done. And then we decided, hey, that was dumb. And I've been I've just finished the Devils of Loudoun, a true story of demonic possession by Aldous Huxley, the guy who did Brave New World.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That was very good. They burned the priest at the stake at the end. It's amazing.
It's Aldous Huxley. He wrote it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
True story. It's wow. It's just a, it's dated. It's very opinionated. This guy, Aldous Huxley's he's a writer. He's not a historian, but it's all true. He's also a Buddhist, so he brings his Buddhist opinion in. But at the end of the day, these were a lot of people who felt quite self-assured that they were on the right side of history and they were doing the right thing. And dang, it was horrible. You read this and you get the feeling that this was the thing that finally convinced the Catholic Church that maybe this exorcism thing need to be a little more reticent about, you know.
Burning at the stake is a bit extreme, yeah.
Yeah, long and short of it was that we had a priest who was a womanizer, which was not uncommon. He felt justified in being one. He wrote essays on how he thought it was fine. And he ended up seducing the prosecutor's daughter.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and so he made an enemy for life. And then you fast forward about 10 years, you have this nunnery where you have this mental illness with a couple nuns. They think the nuns are possessed, so then it becomes this public spectacle, the nuns being exercised almost every day. And then the prosecutor gets involved and he manages to point them all at the priest. So they imagine the priest being the warlock and all the nuns being possessed, and they torture the, it's just, it's no fun. They did horrible things to the guy.
Yes. Well, prejudice is an evil thing.
Yes. And so, yeah, like I said, the crazy thing is everybody felt like they were doing the right thing, but even 20 years later, people involved were like, oh, wow, this was a horrible thing. Why did we ever get involved in this thing? And then I've also started The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy again. I listened to it back in the 80s, and like, oh, I got to hear it again. So I'm going back through it again.
Are you listening to it?
Yes.
Oh, how's the audio? Is it an audible book?
It is an audible book. They've got it in eight parts, so you end up paying quite a chunk of change. Oh. But it's all the original stuff. So, I mean, I've converted to MP3, so now that I've got it, I never have to give it up.
I don't know. Wait a second. You can't do that, right?
Can't do
that. No, never mind. You'll tell me about that later.
No. I'll tell you about it right now, because I buy a book, I own the book, okay?
Yep.
Audible kind of got this deal where if you stop paying them, you can't listen to their books anymore.
Ah.
Yeah.
So how do I have some
profane words for people who think that.
Yeah. So how do you make the Audible book your own?
I can't describe to you how to break this, because that would be breaking the law. But I can tell you
that
there are many, many free, even pre-installed things on a Linux installation that would do this for you right away.
Yeah, okay.
And we will talk later about various ways to do it. But you don't have to go to some Chinese website where you have to put in your credit card number. Everything I found was just free open source.
Yeah, I think, I do subscribe to Audible, so I pay them, a lot. Yes. And it does kind of irk me that I can't loan the book to anybody.
I have 150 books on Audible, and I, about a year ago, decided I didn't want to pay them because I was trying to save money, and they're like, okay, fine, you can't have your books anymore. And at that point, I decided that we weren't going to play this game no more.
Yeah,
I'm not renting the idea of reading my own damn books. That's not happening. I mean, seriously, you pay $10 for paperback, you pay $10 for an audiobook, you got the book or the paperback.
Yeah. I guess the opportunity to share it super widely is there, and, which I can kind of understand not wanting to do that.
Right.
You know.
Now, and, I would never share that book with anybody else, but that's just me.
So, that was not very convincing body language.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, people can find wherever it went, test-driven development for embedded C, free all over the place, although they're stealing when they take that, but there's pirate copies all over the place.
Well, I'll admit it. I hope Bob might get mad at me, but I actually downloaded a few of those TED videos he did. And part of the reason is my internet connection sucks, and I didn't want to be in a spot where I couldn't see it. But part of the reason was I wanted to kind of go through over and over again kind of what he was doing, how he was convincing people. And it was easier just to have the file.
Well, those, I think that's part of the license with that. You know, you can download those for offline watching. Yeah.
And I, as far as I know, I never gave those out either. I have no problem with removing DRM from my own personal use. I do get a little freaky when it comes to, like, giving it away or selling it. That seems...
Yeah, right. Wrong. No, that would be wrong. Yeah, but... Yep. Definitely appreciate people's efforts they put into things that they want to be paid for them. They should be.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, you know, I started on my third book. I framed it up last night. I've got 24 chapters. I think I can probably get 8 done in the next few weeks. And you spend 4 or 5 years on 3 books. You kind of feel like maybe somebody ought to pay you for it. It would really hurt my feelings if somebody got the book. Now, I would give the book away, probably, you know. Now, that's one thing, but to have somebody just steal it and give it away, or just make it
right.
It's sad.
Yeah.
Okay, my friend, let me say goodbye to everybody. Hang on.
Alrighty.
Okie dokie. You have lost yet another hour of your precious time. You could have been studying to be a doctor. Could have been learning organic chemistry with one of these great courses series. You could have been doing a whole bunch of dang other stuff. But no, you had to join us on Nerd Roundup. And we're really happy you came. We'll be back next week. I will see you on the internet.